Hello from Kalispell, Montana. I'm Harry Blazer, your host this evening for a wonderful audio seminar with our special guest, Catherine Austin Fitz, president of Solari at www.solari.com. Tonight's audio seminar is part one of a two-part series under the banner Beyond Socially Responsible Investing and is entitled Is SRI Hazardous to Our Wealth? Welcome, Catherine.
Hi, Harry.
So, Catherine, why don't we begin by giving a definition of three words that you use very often in all of your seminars, and you'll be using them in this one. Popsicle index, wealth, and tapeworm. And so we can also establish a context.
Sure. The popsicle index, Harry, is the percent of people in a community who believe a child can leave their home, go to the nearest place to buy a popsicle, and come home alone safely. So, for example, when I was a child growing up in West Philadelphia, the popsicle index was 100%. It was unthinkable that a child wasn't safe to go up to Spruce Street and buy a popsicle and come home alone. And today in my old neighborhood, it's very low. It's probably about anywhere from 0 to 10%. So Solari's mission is that the popsicle index would be 100% worldwide, and our strategy to help accomplish that is to help teach people how to build a financial and investment system where we can make money from a rising popsicle index.
Okay, so basically it's a welfare index. I feel good about my community. I feel safe. And
it's a wealth index.
Ah.
I don't want to just fare well. I want to be wealthy.
Right, so welfare would be kind of a subset of wealth.
Yes, yes.
Interesting.
Yes.
Okay, so that brings us to wealth.
Right. So when I say wealth, I mean all of our resources, whether they're man-made or natural, whether we manage them with financial and legal systems or not. That means wealth is all our land, our people, all living things, all natural resources, as well as the technology and enterprises that we use to manage and govern them. So the popsicle index, as I said, is my rule of thumb to estimate out the wealth in a place and to have a conversation about what's causing our wealth to increase or decrease.
Okay, so how about this big bad tapeworm?
The tapeworm is my nickname for a negative return on investment economy. That's a economy in a financial system, Harry, in which a few players shrink total wealth in a manner that centralizes and consolidates ownership and wealth in their hands. In other words, it's a financial system where people can make money from doing things that cause the popsicle index to go down. And very simply put, the dividing line between whether an investment is responsible or not is whether or not it's financing and promoting people who cause the popsicle index to go down, as opposed to financing and promoting people who cause the popsicle index to go up.
Well, with a name like socially responsible investing, you'd think that they'd be on the popsicle index up team, right?
Well, I think that's supposed to be the intention.
Okay,
absolutely.
So how would you like to begin now to talk about SRI and if they are living up to their name?
Well, I think we start with a discussion of what is socially responsible investing. What's it supposed to be?
Right. What's it supposed to be? That's a good question.
Well, the notion of socially responsible investing is a very old one. And in theory, it's one that's very compatible with the Solari philosophy, which is vote with your money. In other words, we have the power to build our world. And one of the most powerful tools we have to build our world is with our money. And what we do with our money is important. So the notion of social responsibility in investing is really one of aligning your spiritual or your ethical values with how your money works. In theory, it's investing that measures not just how much, which is how much money are we going to make, but how. How are we making our money? So it reflects analysis of social criteria with financial criteria. What socially responsible investing as an industry has become is something very different, is something that really channels capital of people concerned with social responsibility back into big corporations. It's become an entire industry where the majority of the money is really focused on channeling back and supporting investment in big corporations.
But that's in particular for the high visibility funds and what you might call these liquid
right.
funds.
Right.
Now, there are other types of SRI. Maybe you could tell us a little bit about that.
Right. One way that we tend to look at an investment is investment liquid or is it illiquid? And is it global or is it local? When we say liquid, we mean that you can readily access information on prices and you can trade it. So, for example, if something is traded on a stock exchange, I have a dealer who's prepared to buy and sell at any time. And so my financial asset, a stock, a bond, is liquid. So a lot of the growth in SRI investing over the last couple decades has been in the mutual funds. It's in the liquid. And most of that is in global stocks. So I'm an investor. I buy into a liquid mutual fund, and it's primarily in corporate stocks and bonds, which are everywhere. They're global. Most are global corporations. There's a whole other part, which is illiquid, which is investment and venture and strategic investment, much more focused on small business incubation and incubating businesses that are doing the kind of technology and activities that we'd like to see to build a better world. So it's investment in alternative energy or investment in fresh food or investment in things that really start to create a much more sustainable lifestyle.
So at least in the case of these larger liquid mutual funds, the focus has not been local, it's been otherwise.
So we've very much gone to the global and we've very much gone to the liquid. And now part of Solari's philosophy is to take us back. How do we decentralize political and economic power? And how do we start to bring liquidity to local investment?
But on these non-liquid investments, are some of those local?
You're talking more about angel and venture investment. And it tends to be something that only accredited investors do because it's very risky. Now, if you do it properly and you do it systemically, you can bring the risk down. But traditionally, it's really been the purview of wealthy people.
Okay, and you said accredited investor. What is that?
Accredited investor under the SEC rules is someone who has $1 million or more of assets or a certain level of income. But there's standards of how much assets and income they have to be able to do this kind of, you know, sort of high-risk investment.
So there are different requirements if you're appealing to accredited investors that are supposedly sophisticated investors versus just opening it up to anybody and,
right,
and everybody.
Right. And so as an investment matter, if you're doing venture and you make it accessible to non-accredited people, it becomes much more complicated and the legal liabilities and costs go up tremendously.
So, Catherine, tell us, how do the SRI mutual funds go about deciding who to invest in?
There are three forms of implementation, particularly on the liquid side. One is screening. So screening can be negative. So I exclude a company because it manufactures weapons or it does this or that. Or I include them because they meet certain positive social criteria. So screening is one method of implementation.
Kind of negative screening or positive screening.
Right. The second is shareholder activism. So I'm going to buy a stock in a company that may be bad, but I'm going to use my platform as a shareholder to try and persuade that company to change their practices. But I'm going to use social criteria to influence the behavior of the companies that I invest in. So the second is shareholder activism. The third, which really has started to grow in the 90s, is called community investing, which is a new word for economically targeted investment, which says I'm going to invest capital in communities that are troubled and need investment. The theory being they're troubled because they need investment, so we're investing in it. And that's really grown in response to two factors. One is that there's a real hunger in the investment community to be able to invest in places and communities, particularly somebody's own place. And then the second is, there was legislation passed federally in 1994, and the Clinton administration put a big push, and the U.S. Treasury put a big push in promoting, it's called Community Development Finance Institution, CDFIs. And so you've had a real infrastructure grow up of community financial organizations and institutions who, with the help of the federal government and the sort of mortgage community, have tried to channel investment back into real estate and small business investment in places.
I imagine if I'm interested in getting in the SRI game, I can go to what, investment advisors, or how do I do it?
Well, you can go to financial planners, or obviously you can do everything yourself, but you can go to financial planners and investment advisors who are interested in helping advise you how to manage your money or to do it, in fact, for you. The notion of aligning your moral and ethical values is becoming more a a marketing concept you're going to run into as you start to grapple with how you start to save and retire.
Yeah, but what if I'm not a big player? You know, I don't have much money. What advice do you have for me?
Oftentimes when we do these audio seminars, I have people say to me, well, this is of no interest to me because I have no money. I can be an investor, I can be an investee. And the key to being an attractive investee is to understand what the world looks like from the point of view of the investor. If I'm an entrepreneur and I want to attract investment, I want to understand what the world looks like from the point of view of the person who's investing. In other words, let's say I have an investor who's got $1 million in socially responsible investment fund that are doing nothing but feeding the tapeworm. Well, in fact, if I'm an entrepreneur with a good local business project, I'm potentially a more attractive alternative to that person than what they're doing now. So it helps me to understand how they're looking at their investment portfolio so that I can start to think of myself as an alternative to them.
So basically, these comments are for people with money who want to invest and for people without money who want investment.
Right.
But also in keeping with the concept that you can use your money to change the world, basically anytime you make a purchase, you're making an investment also, right?
Right.
Yeah, so I guess it pays to know what these SRI guys and other folks are thinking about what's a responsible way to deploy your money, because that might actually give you some insights about how you want to spend your money.
Absolutely.
So, Catherine, it seems what you're going to be focusing on is really these larger liquid SRI mutual funds.
Right. For a couple of reasons. One is there's been tremendous growth in this area. It's the area where most of our listeners are apt to run into marketing pitches just because of the size and the growth. But also because it's liquid, it's the easiest to collect data on. So there's a lot more available data to understand the liquid.
Just because of reporting requirements, if nothing else.
Right. Absolutely.
So who's who in this SRI liquid mutual fund market?
This world tends to group out into two basic groups. Groups who are interested in progressive values and groups which are faith-based, so church-based groups. And in addition to the money managers and the mutual fund companies in those two areas, you also have associations and groups that sort of organize the service providers. It's progressive value groups, it's faith-based groups, and then it's the leading industry associations. The two big ones that we're going to use as examples today are two companies, Domini Social Investments, which is a company in Boston, and the Calvert Group, which is in Bethesda outside of Washington, Bethesda, Maryland.
Domini, D-O-M-I-N-I, Social Investments.
Correct.
Calvert, C-A-L-V-E-R-T.
Right. The biggest is Ariel Funds out of Chicago, but Calvert and Domini have created two social index funds, which are very useful in terms of our example. They're funds that index off of their list of socially responsible companies, and those two lists are very useful in terms of getting a sense of what some of the issues are in this world.
Catherine gave me this very interesting thing to read on SRI mutual funds, really. That's what they concentrate on.
It's right. You know, it's the recommended reading for the for this audio seminar.
It's on the resource page, eh?
Uh-huh.
Well, it's from the Natural Capital Institute, and they're at www.responsibleinvesting.org.
Mm-hmm.
Here's a report by Paul Hawken.
Mm-hmm.
Here's a summary. Our conclusion from examining and analyzing the portfolio data and marketing information from SRI mutual funds are summed up as follows. And he has 10 points. 1. The cumulative investment portfolio of the combined SRI mutual funds is virtually no different than the combined portfolio conventional mutual funds. 2. The screening methodologies and exceptions employed by most SRI mutual funds allow practically any publicly held corporation to be considered as an SRI portfolio company. Fund names and literature can be deceptive, not reflecting the actual investment strategy of the managers. SRI fund advertising caters to people's desires to improve the world by avoiding bad actors in the corporate world, but it can be misleading and oftentimes has little correlation to portfolio holdings. There is lack of transparency and accountability in screening and portfolio selection. The ability for investors to do market basket comparisons of different funds is difficult, if not impossible. There is a strong bias towards companies that aggressively pursue globalization of brands, products, and regulations. The environment screens used by portfolio managers are loose and do little to help the environment. The language used to describe SRI mutual funds, including the term SRI itself, is vague and indiscriminate and leads to misperception and distortion of investor goals. And finally, point number 10, although shareholder activism is cited as a reason to invest in SRI mutual funds, few SRI mutual funds engage in shareholder advocacy or sponsor activist shareholder resolutions. It looks like we sure need your help.
Well, I think the best part of NCI's report is on page 17. He creates two lists. One is List A, which is the 30 top holdings.
These are the 30 top holdings of the SRI mutual funds, right?
Yes. And the other is List B, which is the Dow Jones Industrial Average. And it's funny, I asked a very sophisticated, very experienced, socially responsible investor to look at these two lists and tell me which was which, and it took them about 2 minutes to figure it out. And you look at the list of the top holdings by the SRI mutual fund industry, and what you realize is, I mean, some of the worst players on the planet are on this list, in my opinion.
But they're almost identical lists. That's the point.
Right. So there really is very little difference.
So little difference between what the SRI mutual funds are holding and what ordinary mutual funds are holding, but also very little difference between what the SRI mutual funds are holding and the Dow Industrial Index.
Exactly. Another thing the NCI report notes is that it says Walmart was held by 33 SRI funds, Clear Channel was held by 47 SRI funds, Halliburton was held by 23 SRI funds, McDonald's was held by 41 SRI funds, and Monsanto was held by 19 SRI funds.
Yeah, and it's great. Halliburton was held by 23 SRI funds, including the Dow Jones Islamic Index Fund. So is there anyone besides Hawken that's criticizing some of these SRI folks?
There are three primary critiques of socially responsible investment in my experience. One is that it just fails to deliver. In other words, it's a way of marketing the tapeworm to people who feel badly about investing in the tapeworm. And I think what Hawken has done in this report is basically, he's just done a marvelous job of proving this case.
Yeah, pulling the curtain back.
Pulling the curtain back. There are two other critiques, and I think it's important to understand them as well. One is the fundamental responsibility of a corporation is to make money. And so it is pointless and stupid to look at social criteria in the investment of money.
Okay, what you're saying is that's one of the objections other people have.
Correct. There are two problems with that theory. One is, I would argue in the long run, companies and organizations that pay attention to social criteria do better. So paying attention to social criteria and being good at it is one of the best risk management tools in the world. In part two, which is Solari Portfolio Strategy, we'll talk about that more.
And we might mention at this time that part two is called The Power of Solari Optimization Strategies, right?
Right. But the second thing is, when we're operating in a system that depends on government for the rule of law, but you can't depend on government as a rule of law. I've always told the story of the Senate staffer who said, essentially, the government's being run as a criminal enterprise. But when that's the case, when government is being run as a criminal enterprise, and so you can use the United States Treasury and the federal government to rig corporate profits at literally insane rates of return, the theory that I as an investor have a fiduciary obligation to go along with that is madness, because it's saying I should liquidate my planet, I should liquidate my community, and I should liquidate other people all over the world and make money at it, and I have a fiduciary obligation to go along with that. I mean, that's complete insanity.
Right, but the tragedy is that that's why people go into SRI, because they don't want to be accomplices to their own destruction, supposedly.
Right.
But what we're finding out is if they invest in the big companies, they may be doing just that,
right?
Being sold the illusion that they're not. So
right.
It goes back to a very important theme that you've talked about, which is you've got to be responsible.
Right.
And that means you've got to take the time to find out what's really going on.
Right.
Now, luckily, there's information out there so that you can, but basically, large-scale, liquid, mutual fund-based SRI is a scam.
I would say that it's not working.
I'll be a little bit more blunt from my perspective.
There's a third criticism that I think it's important to understand. It's what I call the sound money critics. there's a large contingent in the financial world, and one group that I'm a part of, the Gold Antitrust Action Group, that is really focused on the importance of sound money to a healthy financial system. And our financial system is corrupt because our currency and our transparency systems are corrupted. And they're focused on sound money. And there's a wonderful quote that we have up on the event resource page from Reg Howe at the Golden Sextant, who I'd just like to read. He says, "A recent book entitled Good Money Touts SRI, Socially Responsible Investment, is how to do good socially while doing well financially. But whatever the legal currency, dollars, marks, yens, francs, or pounds, in which practitioners of SRI make their investments, they cannot make bad money good. SRI cannot repeal Gresham's law. Properly understood, good money is good not because of the motives of its owners, but because of its own intrinsic character. Truly good money will produce far more social benefits than any amount of bad money spent with good intentions." Gresham's law, Harry, says that bad money crowds out good. And it's a fundamental principle within the financial world, which is very sound. And one of the things I found is for people who do not spend their lives with money and finance, it's very easy to respond to the symptom of an unhealthy financial system as opposed to the real systemic causes. So, for example, you'll hear me say all the time, what we need to have a healthy financial system is we need sound money, i.e. not a fiat currency like the one we get from the Federal Reserve. We need transparency. So I talk a lot about the importance of place-based transparency and other forms of financial transparency. And finally, we need an equity-based system and not a debt-based system. And as long as we have fiat currency, we have an absence of place-based transparency, particularly of government money, and we don't have an equity-based system, we have a debt-based system, there's no amount of socially responsible investing, by whatever manner you do it, that's going to solve the root problem, because we have real systemic flaws. And so it's very, I think what the sound money critics say, and say very rightly, is it's very important, if we're going to get from here to there, to look at those systemic fixes that have to happen. There's no amount of socially responsible investment that will make up for having fiat currency and a federal credit mechanism that can be used to drive the kind of corruption we're looking at today.
Are the hard money people saying, jeepers, you just shouldn't make an investment in dollars or other fiat currencies or modern currencies?
No, what they're saying, which is very important to understand, this is a criticism that is really worth understanding, is that bad money drives out good, and more bad money used for a good purpose won't change anything. And the community investing that you'll find is a perfect example of that. And to understand it, let's look at how the money works in a neighborhood. Let's take my old neighborhood of West Philadelphia that I grew up in and watch the popsicle index go from 100% to down to almost nothing. What went wrong in that neighborhood was what happened because the absence of capital, and the answer is no. The problem wasn't the absence of capital. The first problem was the presence of drugs. Somebody brought drugs in. And then, and we now believe it to be the same somebody started to use HUD programs to engage in financial fraud. So the neighborhood got hit with drugs and crime related to the drugs, number one. But then we had the equity in our homes wiped out by a series of fraudulent home builder deals and financial mechanisms, which wiped out the value of the homes. So the two things cause the neighborhood to deteriorate. The education deteriorates, and more of the economic activities in the neighborhood start to be centralized under the control of a variety of central players that wipes out the small business people. So whether our home equity is getting wiped or our small business's equity is getting wiped, we are the target of a series of interventions which are criminal. Now, what do we need? Do we need someone to come and invest more capital, or do we need those criminal interventions to stop?
Okay, so one of the things you're saying is that sometimes these socially responsible investment funds that are telling you, hey, we're going to invest in this community, is just another way for the criminal enterprise to get money.
Right, because let's look at my old neighborhood. What we needed was for HUD to leave that neighborhood. I needed government programs and government guaranteed programs and government credit to leave that neighborhood.
Do it right or leave.
We just needed them to leave, okay? We had capital before they came. When they came in, they wiped out our capital, okay? So when you come into my neighborhood and with a series of these mechanisms, you wipe out my capital, I become dependent on you for your capital, okay? And then you can control me. Let me give you an example. In 1998 or 1999, I had lunch with the council to a committee that was in charge of authorizing HUD legislation. And the council took me aside and said, look, you know, you've been working on these venture funds to help small business liquefy their equity in communities and to incubate new businesses in communities. Now, what you need to understand is we're not going to allow that to happen. All equity into these communities has to flow through the control of the CDFI network and their funds, Enterprise and LISC. What he was saying is the CDFI network was going to have a monopoly, and a small businessman couldn't liquefy, raise, or build equity. He had to go through this network. Now, the implication between the lines was these communities are not going to be allowed to build equity. They are going to have to do their development in a not-for-profit model, and we're going to operate it so whether it's their business equity or their real estate equity, it's controlled outside. It's an imperialist model.
Yeah, I mean, the way I would look at it is that these guys need to get their cut, and they want all money to go through that mechanism
right.
So that they can get their cut.
Well, I think it's partly that, but I think the other thing is, if you're draining off huge resources by controlling these communities, including the narcotics trafficking, so if I'm draining money out, I need the ability to put more money back in, but still maintain control. I mean, this is how the tapeworm operates. So I'm running a drain, and I can't continue to make money on the narcotics business unless I keep the liquidity going. How do I do that?
So the taxpayer needs to subsidize the flow in so that the criminal enterprises can have money that they can pull out.
Right. So this is how a negative return on investment happens in a place. And in the broadest terms, if you look at how we're running Iraq, it's no different than how we're running my neighborhood in West Philadelphia. Now, it's hidden behind all sorts of complexity. It's hidden behind lots of different players.
And it's hidden behind a guise of respectability.
Right. The power of the imperialist model, whether we do it in West Philadelphia or Iraq, is to make it socially acceptable. How can I rape a place? How can I destroy the capital of the people in the place and have them be financially dependent on me? I need a way of making that socially acceptable. And that's where SRI, community investing, comes in. So the next thing you know, I have all this desire to finance communities or this desire to help communities financing my imperial control and ability to continue to drain communities. It's the ultimate masterful Orwellian stroke. And what do I have? I have all these folks essentially fronting. I had a wonderful friend of mine who went to work at one of the CDFIs, and they got big contracts both in this country and abroad through the federal government to go in with these programs to help communities. And I said to her, I said, you know, you're just putting a pretty front face on organized crime. You're fronting for organized crime. And she said, I know.
But a lot of folks don't know.
Right.
And hopefully this will shed some light on the subject. But how does this relate to the hard money people?
This is a circumstance. The community investing that we're watching is often a situation where bad money, more bad money, makes things worse. I mean, one, it prevents folks from sitting back and saying, okay, what is going on here? What's causing the popsicle index to go down? But the other thing is it distracts. You're making the market worse. And you are empowering the players who've been draining the neighborhood, giving them the ability to drain it more. You're making the world safer for organized crime.
And unfortunately, SRI is dealing with a lot of bad money.
The single biggest cause of a negative return on investment economy is the absence of truth. And unfortunately, what the SRI industry has become is a marketer of an obfuscation of the real problem. It's become bad money. And the question is, can we turn that around?
which goes back to a theme that you've been promoting in all of your audio seminars. Basically, we need to re-engineer the way money works.
Right. So in summary, the traditional criticisms of SRI investing is, one, it fails to deliver. Two, social criteria shouldn't be part of investing. And three, it fails to address the root problem when your financial system is fundamentally unsound.
Okay, so now we know how others have criticized SRIs, and we've heard your comments regarding their perspectives. Do you have other criticisms as to why SRI may be hazardous to our wealth?
My most important critique is, if we want to engage in socially responsible investment, we need a map of how the world works. And that includes a map of where is socially irresponsible behavior coming from, who's doing it, and how does the money work on that. I mean, when I pick up the Domineer, the Calvert Social Index, and I look at some of the most socially irresponsible companies and groups of people in the world held out to me as being socially responsible, that's scary to me because it says I'm either being encouraged to invest in companies which are destroying the planet, I'm being encouraged through a back door to support the war machine, to support the economic hit process, to support the dirty players, or even worse, I'm being invited to put my money with people who are clueless about how the world works. And I think my second biggest criticism relates to this. If you don't have a map of how the world really works, then your money is not safe. In other words, if I'm putting my money with an investment advisor who's not clear about how the money really works, then I run significant risks. And I think the number one risk we run in this model is the risk of not being diversified. And let me explain why. We've gone through a process of centralizing political economic power, and I've gone into this in all the other audio seminars, so I'm not going to repeat that whole history here. But as a result, we have a stable of corporations in this country who are highly dependent on government contracts, government subsidies, and financial support that come out of the federal budget and the federal credit mechanism. And as a result, you know, I will often look at a portfolio that's got 50 stocks and 50 different kinds of bonds, and all of them are entirely dependent on the U.S. Treasury. I mean, I might as well have a portfolio of just U.S. Treasuries. And the problem with that is it's not diversified. If the Treasury should have trouble rolling over the debt, I'm betting the ranch on one thing. I'm betting the ranch on the war machine, which is fine if I want to support the war machine and bet the ranch on the war machine. But it's not fine if I'm looking for true diversification. And diversity is the number one risk management tool for any investor.
Is your feeling that these guys are kind of ignorant about what's really going on, the real deal, as you call it?
I think it's a combination of events. There's tremendous pressure on them to invest in corporations. And I also think that investors are hungry for liquid investments. If you invest in a group of large corporations who look like the S&P 500, then your performance is going to track the S&P 500. If your performance is down, but the S&P 500 is down, you're okay with your investors. You're okay with your consumers, with your customer. So I think a lot of these companies have found themselves between wanting to do socially responsible investing, but having a group of consumers who have a kind of multiple personality disorder.
Investing in socially responsible companies means that you should be expecting a lower return?
Let's assume for the purposes of the conversation that there's a natural yield. Okay, so if you look at what the planet creates in terms of harvests and natural resources, that there's a natural yield of, say, 5 to 7%, which is perfectly possible and healthy. Okay? If we use the federal resources to rig a yield for certain activities of 35%, you know, for example, I'm always reading that Carlyle has a 35% return. That yield ultimately depends on the planet losing, people losing, or, you know, somebody in that game losing, because it's above what is a naturally feasible and healthy return. in that construct, if I want to match the market rate of 35%, I can't without destroying the planet.
Is there a way to get a return, any type of return, whether it's 5% or 30%, without having somebody else suffer so you can gain, in your opinion?
Yeah, absolutely. There is a way to get good, sustainable returns. The challenge is the fewer people who will play with you and play in that way, the harder it is to do.
In other words, see, to me, this is the core question, because people are saying, well, maybe one of the reasons these good-intentioned people end up emulating investment strategies of typical mutual funds is because that's the only way that they can get a respectable yield, which is what the customer wants. So are there opportunities out there to be found? And if not, how do we make those opportunities for truly social responsible investing?
Well,
or do we not try to kid ourselves?
In an economy that is managed for fundamental economics, there is absolutely a way to invest with long-term economic trends and make fine returns. I mean, that the history of great investment is the history of investment that does that. The notion of building wealth and staying focused on doing those things which are economically sound and sticking to them is a form of investment that absolutely works. At the same time, you have to be prepared to look out of fashion, and in the short run to have yields that are out of fashion. For example, several years ago, I started to teach people about the opportunity to invest in precious metals. Now, precious metals aren't an investment. They're an alternative form of money. What I and the group from the Gold Antitrust Action Committee were saying was the quality of the currencies is deteriorating, and that means that the relative value of financial assets versus real assets will change, and precious metals will be perceived as a form of real money, and as people find fiat currency unattractive, they'll dump it and buy precious metals. Well, in fact, what you've seen happen over the last several years is in dollar prices, the price of precious metals has consistently gone up, okay? But it's gone up in a way where it's very volatile. So you will see some people who buy precious metals, and then the next day it's down $20, and they're, oh, my God, you know. So they're unhappy with that volatility because they continue to measure their wealth in dollars as opposed to ounces. And Franklin Sanders will always tell everybody, measure your wealth in ounces. And I always say, Franklin, you need to tell them, measure your wealth in ounces, acres, hooves, because investment is really a form of strategic resource governance and collaborating to govern our resources. And I think anybody knows you need to govern resources wisely. So the question is how you do that. And that's only going to work if the consumer is informed and prepared to think in terms of measuring their wealth in real assets as opposed to fiat currency that can be, you know, that can be manipulated, and now stock market prices that can be manipulated up and down. So we have to have the stomach to invest strategically as opposed to invest in a way where we're always comparing ourselves to a manipulated price.
So, Catherine, let me ask this question. Can you really be socially responsible if you're investing in a fund that's primarily investing in New York Stock Exchange and NASDAQ large corporations?
Well, that gets to our next critique, which is our philosophy is that the fundamental problem in the economy is that we're centralizing political and economic power. And at this juncture, all decentralization is good. So to me, socially responsible investment is going to have a focus of decentralization. And so I can't fathom a socially responsible investment that promotes large corporations. You know, it's Orwellian to say that there's such a thing as socially responsible investment in large corporations. Now, can I be persuaded that there's a large corporation that's a good company? Absolutely. But the reality is if I'm concerned about socially responsible investment, then what I'm really concerned about is how do we decentralize political and economic power as fast as possible, commensurate with having liquidity. So I can't fathom putting any money in large corporations. the point of this seminar is not to go into the whole question of the corporate model, but there's no doubt that the corporate model as it currently exists under law is fundamentally flawed. Basically what it says is, I as a corporation have the rights of a person, but I don't have the responsibilities of a person. So if a corporation commits murder, there's no death penalty for the corporation. So you have a legal mechanism in which crime will always pay. So essentially what we're saying is a corporation can act like a criminal, pay its fine, and keep the money and be socially responsible and socially acceptable. But, you know, so there's a madness to the corporate model, which if we want to build a beautiful world, has got to be dealt with as a legal matter. And that's another reason why it's so important to think in terms of how we avoid doing anything with our investing dollar to promote more centralization. One of the things I've covered in these audio seminars, Harry, is the housing bubble. And the extraordinary debate that occurred in Washington and in the financial communities in the 90s between those of us who really wanted to move to transparency of government money, reengineering of government investment by place, a moving away from debt to equity, making liquid equity accessible to small business, and making liquid equity accessible to communities, so communities, for example, could finance in the stock market. The whole notion being, we knew that jobs were going to go away. We knew that if the American middle class was going to preserve its retirement savings and was going to continue as a force, which is really the bedrock of democracy, we knew we needed to make changes. We knew that the jobs were going abroad and that a crunch was coming in terms of sustainable lifestyles. What happened, and again, I've covered this in the housing bubble audio seminar and other audio seminars, a decision was made rather than to make the necessary changes, instead to bubble the economy with significant amounts of consumer and mortgage and government debt and basically delay the day of reckoning. And the companies who were real leaders in that housing bubble and that effort to sort of get America up to its eyeballs in debt are in many of these portfolios. And let me just give some names. Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, J.P. Morgan Chase, GE, Citigroup. And these are also the same companies, many of them, particularly the banks, who are implicated in the missing money. I've talked a lot about the fact that $4 trillion is missing from the federal government. If you look at the players who were complicit in that, because they're the banks for the agencies, or very significant in the sort of federal credit political game in Washington, or the media, who's been silent throughout, the Washington Post and New York Times, again and again, as you look at the social indexes of socially responsible investment, or the portfolio, it's the same players. I call it the fraudulent inducement of America. Fraudulent inducement is when I loan you money, knowing that you can't afford to pay it back, and I don't tell you. In other words, I have access to information that you don't have. And I feel very strongly that there has been a real systemic fraudulent inducement of the American consumer to take on debt that they can't afford to pay back as the jobs move abroad. And what's most frightening to me personally is you see a lot of the same players in the equity portfolios as well as the community investing portfolios. And so basically what socially responsible investment has done in the mutual fund industry is find a way to make the economic hit process that's wiping out the American middle class and the warfare model look good.
Okay, so Catherine, again, from this report from the Natural Capital Institute, you know, at responsibleinvesting.org, that's one of the folks you refer to on your resource page. Here's a great comment. It's under the criticism that the environmental screens used by portfolio managers are loose and do little to help the environment. He says, take the Sierra Club stock fund, for example. There is not a single company in their portfolio that addresses the environment in an innovative or proactive way. There is no company that measures its ecological footprint. There are no alternative energy companies. They invest in companies that make surge protectors, fastening screws, steakhouses, anti-wrinkle creams, and candy bars. They are investors in Cousins Properties, one of the major contributors to Spro in Atlanta. I single out the Sierra Club because of the nature of the organization. Founded by John Muir, it is one of the oldest and most respected NGOs in the world working for land conservation. What's an NGO, by the way?
Non-governmental organization.
Okay, so you think, hey, if anybody should have their act together, the Sierra Club should. So I guess as a way of emphasizing this, that not only is there a very reasonable critique that these SRI funds are, as you say, they're not delivering what's promised or what's expected, but probably they never could if they're dedicated to investing in the major exchanges.
If I, as the customer, want to invest in large global corporations, there is no way for me to do that on a socially responsible basis.
And these SRI companies seem to be ending up investing in exactly the same companies that most mutual funds do.
Well, but there's a chicken and egg question. Are they investing in that way because that's what the consumer wants? That's the question. And I think, you know, what has to emerge here is the customer saying, I don't want that. Because the growth has come in that sector. And if the growth is coming in that sector, it's because that's what the consumer is buying. Now, what's interesting is I have seen socially responsible funds which are truly socially responsible. They're doing a good job.
But more on a local level, small cap.
It's much more small cap, or it's focused on how do we create alternative energy companies? How do we, you know, so it's focused on a functional area which is important to develop if we're going to have sustainable lifestyles. So those exist. And I think, you know, there's a chicken and an egg thing. Is that what the consumer wants? If it is, then that's the sector that will grow. But this has to come out of the consumer, because any investment advisor or business person who tries to create a powerful product or a powerful series of mutual fund has got to have real consumer support for strategic resource governance. And they've got to be able to have sufficient supports to be able to do it outside the tapeworm. Because there's going to be tremendous pressure from the traditional corporate model to win people back into it.
And they win them back by basically providing good returns.
By providing good returns or providing, you know, very significant marketing.
And the illusion of good returns, financial returns, and the illusion of safety.
I think anybody who got slaughtered during, you know, any investor got slaughtered by Enron or by the 2000 pump and dump of the internet stocks or telecom, I think the good returns can all, you know, often be disillusioning. If I said to most investors, to have a map of what's socially responsible, we need to have a map of what's socially irresponsible. What they would say is, I don't want to go there. I don't want to look at that because it's too scary. It's too overwhelming. I don't want to face the fact that the fundamental system is illegitimate because that just seems too scary, too overwhelming for me to deal with. So that's another chicken and an egg problem we have. How can the investment advisor deal with looking at the real deal if the consumer's not willing to be supportive of doing so? But something's beginning to turn, because as one of my favorite books is, we've had 100 years of psychotherapy and the world is getting worse. And I almost laugh, because the world has had 50 years of socially responsible investment and the world is getting worse. So, you know, a lot of socially responsible investment has focused more on the process as opposed to performance, which is, to me, a performance system says, why is the Popsicle Index not 100%? Who's doing that? Who's making money on the Popsicle Index not being 100%? And the test that it's working is the Popsicle Index is going up, right? So you have to get out of the process of, does J.P. Morgan use this kind of employment process and is it considered a good workplace for, you know, this kind of people, to, you know, where's the Popsicle Index in the world that J.P. Morgan banks in? We have to hold ourselves to that. Because that's a satisfying performance standard. We're not using performance standards that can ever satisfy. We're using process standards that allow us to come up with what, from a performance standpoint, is a completely insane result. What I find to be really one of the most interesting things in looking at the social indices of the big companies, Harry, is I find that the average person in America, simply using their own intuition, has a much better sense of what is and is not a socially responsible investment. So, for example, there was a discussion going on in my church, and somebody said, well, how do you know that's true? And the other person said, I read it in the New York Times, and the whole congregation just burst out laughing. And the reason they burst out laughing is, you ask anybody in my church, and they know you can't trust a word the New York Times says. So, you know, it would never occur to them that that's a reliable source of information about the real deal. And so if you said to somebody, you know, is investing in the New York Times socially responsible? They'd say, of course not. They lie to me. The average person has a much better sense just by intuition of how to implement screening criteria than these indices. And I bet if you sat down with just the man on the street and said, okay, we want you to take, here's $1 million, we want you to pick, you know, socially responsible investment, they'd probably do a better job than these indices. The notion that we need an expert to do this defies the power of financial intimacy. The average person managing their own 401k or IRA or investments, I think, can do a more responsible job on their own or networking. And that's part of the idea behind Solari Circles is, you know, let's start to network and help each other build a financially intimate world.
We think we are investing time and energy and money to support something that is represented a certain way, and we find out, in fact, gosh, it's not that way at all.
In fact, it's the opposite.
Right. And so that's certainly one of the themes here.
Right.
But the other theme is that, especially in the United States, given SEC requirements, you can find out a lot about the companies that are investing, who
Absolutely.
They're investing in. And so then it's a question of just having the right kind of map, knowing what to do, how to interpret that information.
Right.
And again, we shouldn't fall for the marketing hype. This is one of the major messages you've been giving us, that these so-called respectable companies, they're oftentimes doing very unrespectable things.
Right.
We need to hold them responsible, and we're not going to accept from them the explanation that, hey, I didn't know, and we can't accept that explanation for ourselves either.
Right. Well, and one way to do it is to only invest in that which you know. Only invest in that which you're interested in. There's no obligation in this universe to invest in everything. And so one of the things I used to do when I was on Wall Street is I would only invest in that which, in the area, in the sector that I was working in. But it was back to this notion of financial intimacy, of really having an intimate understanding of what you're investing in and having an intimate connection to it.
By way of summary, why don't we take a minute and just go over once again your criticisms of current SRI offerings, you might say, on the liquid, larger cap, publicly traded mutual funds.
You can engage in socially responsible investing unless you have a clear picture of the economy, which includes where social irresponsibility is happening. And so an investment advisor who's purporting to be involved in socially responsible investing has to have that map.
That's point one.
Point one. Point two, if you develop such a map, what you know is the greatest threat to the health and well-being of this planet and to freedom on this planet is the centralization of economic and political power. And so socially responsible investment must have, as one of its guiding principles, the strategic decentralization of political and economic power. So the notion that we can invest in big corporations and be socially responsible is contradictory. It's not possible. The third thing is one of the great principles of managing risk as an investor is diversification. And so the notion that you can invest in a group of corporations who are entirely dependent on the federal credit budget and mechanism for their profitability flies in the face of diversification. If we do that, we're entirely dependent on the war machine. And we are entirely dependent on the economic hit process. So we are supporting the very thing that we say we want to pull out of. And that's not just a social problem. That's a real financial problem. We're not diversified. We're financing the guy who's killing us. or killing our communities or killing our families. So it's not sound financial practice. And finally, if we want to be involved in socially responsible investing, we have to grapple with the fact that the corporate model as it currently exists, particularly in combination with corrupt government, is financially insane, not to mention ethically and morally insane. And that has to be grappled with. So the notion that we can sweep up our money and promote not only the corporate model, but large global corporations who are highly dependent on corrupt government
You can't get there from here.
You can't get there from here. You can't get there. Now, I say all of this, and I really I have to give a medal to the guy who goes out there and tries. So I find the socially responsible industry is full of a lot of people who've really tried to sit down and go through the effort of saying, well, how would I vote with my money? How would I invest on a socially responsible basis? How would I combine social criteria and social values with the investment of my money successfully? So you have a lot of infrastructure, a lot of work, a lot of good people who've grappled with these issues. And what you don't want to do is you don't want to lose them. The question is how you take their work, you take their organizations, you take that infrastructure and go to the next level, which is, okay, you know, it's sort of what I call an economic warfare model. There's this team that's centralizing economic and political power. You know, we want a decentralization team. We need to be a we. We need to have a plan. How do we do that? So how do we take this model of economic warfare and how do we come together to shift the state of play in a very powerful way? And if a lot of the people who've got the smarts that's been created around socially responsible investment can start to shift things in a way that really attracts the average consumer and investor into that model, then you're talking about something that can, that has the power to really shift things. And that's why in part two, we're going to talk about the power of the Solari portfolio strategy, which is really a framework through which consumers and investors interested in socially responsible investment could start to really do things that lower the cost of capital to good-hearted people everywhere and raise the cost of capital to the tapeworm, which is really at the heart of what we want to do if we're going to change how money works.
So, Catherine, we've spent time talking about the state of the liquid mutual fund SRI industry and, I guess, what not to do.
Right.
How can you help us on what we can do, what we should be doing?
There are many things we can do, Harry. The first is to build a really great map of how the world works. Turn off your TV and corporate media. Switch that time and money to real deal media. Great media has grown up around the internet that helps you understand the real deal on investments and finance. That includes the audio seminars. We've distilled down both in the audio seminars and in the event resources page all the best links, all the best books, all the best research. Start to see your news as through the lens of your investment portfolio. You should be getting news that informs you about your world as a citizen, as a consumer, as an investor in one integrated map. A lot of people think of their investment portfolio as something separate from their day-to-day news. If we're thinking strategically about resources and our investment, it's one integrated view of the world. And your investment portfolio is a great way to really see the world whole. So getting a good map is step one.
I can tell you from personal experience that Solari.com is one of the best resources out there for helping to develop a map of the real deal. The website itself, plus all those audio seminars you can get through the website, plus the great resource pages that are associated with each audio seminar. You've done a great service. It's a tremendous resource.
The second is vote with your money. The average person has a pretty good sense of who's centralizing political and economic power, who's decentralizing it, and who's making your popsicle index go up and who's making your popsicle index go down. So with our purchases, with our time and attention, we can start to act in our day-to-day lives to decentralize economic and political power, switch to a well-managed local bank. Don't bank at the big guys. If you want to know more, we've got a great audio seminar called Where Would Jesus Bank? And I really encourage everyone to get that audio seminar, to learn about how to do this and to switch their deposits from the large banks to a well-managed local bank. The third thing we can do is we can seek out the financial planners and the investment advisors who really do practice responsible strategic investment, whether or not they call themselves SRI, and do it in a way where we avoid getting caught in the SRI hype that we've been talking about in this audio seminar. To help our listeners do that, we've put two resources up on the event resource page. The first is a document I wrote for family. It's called Risks to Inform Investment Strategy, and it's the kind of document or questions you can ask your financial planner and investment advisor to help make sure that your portfolio is managed in a way that reflects sort of the real deal risks. The second is called Criteria for Selecting an Investment Advisor, and it's something that I prepared for a friend, and it can help you walk through the different kinds of questions and criteria you can use to seek out an excellent investment advisor. So the third thing you can do is you can seek out excellent help and not get caught up in the SRI hype in the process of doing that. Finally, we live, Harry, in a world of economic warfare, and I tell everybody, don't worry about whether or not there is a conspiracy. If you're not in one, you need to start one. So start to share with family and friends the opportunity to get a better map, to vote with your money, and organize to start to advantage each other and yourselves. It's one of the reasons we promote a Solari Investment Circle, which is an investment club where you get together and you help each other do this. Whether it's get a good map, vote with your money, avoid the SRI hype and choose an excellent financial advisor or an investment advisor, and then organize in a circle to play to win in economic warfare. Those are some of the things you can start to do. This audio seminar is part one of a two-part series called Beyond Socially Responsible Investing. Part two is called Power of the Solari Optimization Strategies, and we're going to get into in great detail how you can diversify and decentralize your portfolio, your investment portfolio, in very responsible ways. And I would really encourage everyone to listen to part two.
So where there's Solari, there's hope, eh?
The advantage of understanding the negative return on investment economy, the advantage of understanding the tapeworm and seeing really how the tapeworm works, is you then have the beginnings of turning that negative return to a positive. And the hardest thing for me to communicate sometimes, Harry, is the extraordinary wealth that can be created if we just stop destroying wealth. As long as we're centralizing wealth in a way that destroys wealth, we're shrinking the pie. The minute we change that and we start expanding the pie, there's incredible wealth to be made. In particular, we're talking about switching to a form of investment in which the more we heal the environment, the more we switch to a sustainable economy, the greater the capital gains. So we're talking about creating a financial system where we can make money achieving all the things that we want. So the wealth potential is enormous. We just have to envision a way of making money from doing things that don't harm, of generating financial profits and capital gains from doing things which increase the pie and make the pie bigger.
So our theme song is not going to be Call Me Irresponsible. You've been listening to Beyond Socially Responsible Investing, Part 1, part of a group of audio seminars that are tools for building natural and financial wealth. And you can find the entire list of these wonderful audio seminars at www.solari.com. So we want to thank you, Catherine, for being here. And you usually end with an invocation.
Yes, I'd like to introduce the Solari prayer team leader, Eliana Obadiah. Eliana?
Catherine, Harry, thank you so much. You know, every one of these teleseminars has been so powerful. And I just want to say, Catherine, you are so clear, not just in how you're educating us, but in the way in which you transmit to us so strongly your confidence that we can actually have the power to rebuild our world if we just take it. And every time I hear from you, we can re-engineer the way that the money works in our world, and we can do it in a way that is ethically and socially responsible and still is not naive about the deep systemic problems that we have to face. So I thank you for that. So now this is the time when we invite your listeners to just take a few minutes to anchor what's been said. And we do that by calling on the divine forces, whatever that is for each person who's listening. And we ask that that divine power help to bring the truths that have been spoken here into reality in each one of our own lives. And that means in our own learning and the way that we begin to change our thinking, in the way that we see our world differently, and ultimately in all the choices that make the difference. So just take some silent time to go in and touch into the place where we have the power to see clearly, to use that judgment and intuition that you were talking about, that we can know and that we can work from. And we can see what's healthy and what gives life and energy to the planet. Just allow yourself to find that place where that lives in you. And just sit in there gently and know that you know. And that what is true and is good registers in your being as true and good. And that you can have confidence in that, and you can act from that, and you can move in that with other people who also know. From that place, we can affirm together that we don't, as Harry phrased it so beautifully, we don't have to be unwitting accomplices to our own destruction. That we can collaborate with one another and learn from one another how to use our money, our investments, as a form of wise strategic resource governance. And just give thanks that the Solari model has been created to provide us with a map that can help us to navigate our way through this territory. Together we pray that we can learn how to trust ourselves and one another, and we declare that we are willing, as Catherine said, to take the time to learn, to become informed, to see the things that we need to see that need to be changed, and have the courage to do that. We declare ourselves committed to creating a financially intimate world where we can align our spiritual values with how our money works. We take on the challenge of creating the change that we want to see. And also we support one another in releasing any fear of facing that which is difficult to face about the current system, or in ourselves changing old patterns that we've fallen into, not even knowing sometimes how they serve the tapeworm instead of the best interests of everyone on the planet. And we affirm that we can live sustainably and abundantly and in deep connection with one another and the earth. And so as we now go about our lives and we do the things that we do, we look to our own divine resources, whatever they are for each one of us, for the courage to step out and sincerely grapple with the things that have been brought to our attention in this seminar. And as we connect with others in our lives who share the same goals, we give thanks that we are part of a growing transformational network and that we don't have to do this alone. May each one of you be blessed, and we look forward to hearing about all the changes and successes that this information is bringing into your lives, and we look forward to having you with us in part 2. signing off. Bye to all.